What I was doing yesterday was to introduce the constraints of classical general relativity. So what we had there were these four first class constraints. So four, if you like, per space-time point. And they really correspond to, I mean, the four really corresponds to the kind of four independent local directions in which I can perform a local diffeomorphism. Then we saw that they satisfy, as they should, as first-class constraints, a closing algebra, which I just wrote down. I first wrote it down kind of for the local expressions. And of course, one should remember that they're actually, well, that they're functionals. So one way of writing this sometimes is, so keeping track of the function dependent on the fields is like this. So these were the three, that was the Hamiltonian constraint, H perpendicular, and well, this was the notation. Now this is more extended, if you like, notation. I can, of course, also adopt for the other constraint, depending on the fields and the conjugate momenta pi. We saw that the algebra, the Poisson algebra, the form is not isomorphic to the four-dimensional Lie algebra of diffeomorphisms. And this has just happened because we've performed this decomposition, 3 plus 1 decomposition. So actually, for the subalgebra, everything still worked out all right. The subalgebra of the spatial diffeomorphism constraints, their algebra, as we saw, was isomorphic to the three-dimensional diffeomorphism algebra, but not that ceased to be true when we adjoined this Hamiltonian constraint there. I then turn to some general arguments that says, well, how do we in general go about in the presence of constraints? And I wrote down a little, well, commutative or otherwise diagram that said you might think of doing two different things. You might first constrain the system classically, so solve the constraints. So then you are on the physical, just working with the physical degrees of freedom and quantize those. But that is really only feasible if the constraint structure is kind of simple enough so that kind of the space that remains is, well, preferably linear or sufficiently simple so I still know what it means to quantize, what the quantum theory of that is. Usually, this way of doing things is barred from us. And what we resort to is what I called a Dirac quantization, which consists of first kind of formally quantizing the full extended system with all the degrees of freedom, including the gauge degrees of freedom in there, and then trying to get rid of the gauge redundancy by imposing certain operator constraints on the wave functions. So that's what I called a Dirac quantization. And someone asked, well, is there actually a simple kind of finite dimensional example of where I can see that these two processes are not necessarily commutative? And here is a little reference. That's a paper I wrote a long time ago when I wasn't much older than you are now. 3785. If you're interested in an explicit example of such a non-commutative structure. Okay, so proceeding further, well, of course, as you already saw in finite dimensions, well, things can potentially go wrong, and you can have, for instance, these factor ordering problems, and we'll find all of these problems in the quantum theory. They apply also more specifically for the quantization when you have constraints around. One could say then there are even some additional difficulties that appear. If you recall what I one of my conditions for the thing, for the system to be classically of first class, was that the constraint had to close under taking the Poisson brackets. So again, if those f's, if they happen to be constants, then these are kind of they're Lie algebra relations or isomorphic to such relations. If these are constant, well, then all you can say is you have a closing algebra, and that is sufficient to be a first-class constraint system. Now, a problem now appears. So remember, in this Dirac quantization, what I was kind of asked to do in order to implement the classical constraints at the quantum level, I had to find suitable operator representations of all of these constraints and project out wave functions. So all wave functions that are, I consider physical, are those that are kind of annihilated by all of these constraints. So for all my A, for all the first class constraints in the system. And we saw for a very simple example where, say, this was a finite dimensional quantum mechanical Hilbert space, and this was, say, one momentum direction. It just translated into the condition that this function should be constant along the direction of the conjugate variable. Say, if that was a P3, then these were exactly the wave functions that were constant along Q3, so the canonically conjugate position variable. And that clearly made, well, seemed to do just the right thing in the simple example, but the claim is that you should use such a condition more generally. Now, however, keeping in mind that I also want to preserve this thing here, gives now rise to a so-called consistency condition on the constraints. So, namely, so I call this Dirac consistency. And it's a condition that we must have at the operator level that these also, and the commutators, just that the commutator of two quantum constraints now should also vanish on physical wave functions. Well, it comes, of course, from this condition here. And here I required for this to be a closing algebra. Now, this condition is less trivial at the quantum level because, again, of the way in which the kind of quantized version of these things appear up here. I have absolutely no problem if these are constraints, if these are constants, because then they are not turned into operators. But imagine these are also field dependent. It's not an issue at the classical level. You know, this still weakly vanishes on the right hand side. But imagine these now depend on my Q's and P's. Then it should better happen that when I take this commutator, that this the operator version of this should appear to the right of whatever quantized structure functions come out here, right, in order for this to be the case. So unfortunately, well, this will not in general happen. So it's not actually that from this in general will follow. So doesn't follow, I should write, if I have these classical relations, that at the quantum level, things, let me write the IH bar here explicitly, look like FABC quantized, whatever that is, constraint sequantized. If it comes out like that with all the quantized constraints to the right, this is clearly satisfied. If it doesn't, well, then we have a problem. And why do we have a problem? Because then we get additional conditions on top of those. Then kind of taking the commutators and demanding consistency must mean whatever I get on the right-hand side must also annihilate physical wave functions. Yes?
You can naively apply the commutators to psi physical. Then we already have the condition that phi over the state is here. So
yeah.
Say like phi A times phi B.
I start with demanding this. So now I have some physical subspace of my auxiliary Hilbert space that comes out, hopefully like this. Now what I'm saying is that's not enough. In addition, you have to require for consistency that if I take the commutator of a pair of those, this also annihilates the constraints. And I say that's perfectly fine if it just so happens. I mean, that's a calculation, right? You're given these explicitly in some representation, in some form. You make such calculation, and it better come out that, well, these guys appear to the right, because then, of course, the consistency condition is satisfied. If they don't come out to the right, then in general, I will get additional conditions. So I will then reduce my wave function space further. And in general, this will mess. Kind of with my degrees, I will kill more degrees of freedom than I wanted to. And, well, in principle, I could, like that, I could kill all my degrees of freedom. Simply because, well, part of this algebraic structure, well, is not reflected in the quantum theory. So, and this can just happen in principle. So if that is not the case, so in general, what would be the general result? The outcome of this computation. So this will be psi hat A, phi hat A, phi hat B. It will be something, well, these are not all to the left, but of course, by commuting them through, I can then arrange a term which does have the phi's all to the right, but in the process, I will pick up commutator terms. Okay, so in general, what will happen here is that this is equal to I H bar F ABC quantized sum over C phi C plus higher order terms in H bar. Well, with the same index structure, of course. So this thing here. And if that is the case, then we get extra from the consistency condition, we get extra conditions. Namely that DIB, DAB psi should also vanish. And this is what goes by the name of an anomaly. The classical algebra of constraints acquires an extra term in the manner I've explained in the quantum theory. So that is called, and of course they, well, if these generated, well, they generated some action of Hamiltonian vacuums that was an involution. But of course this is now, if I have such additional terms, well, what I'm getting at the quantum level is something different. I mean, something that has more, potentially more degrees of freedom. So especially if that happened to be Lie algebra relations, so for example, you're doing electromagnetism or you're doing kind of Young-Mills type gauge theories, you have local gauge invariants floating around. You have constraints in the Hamiltonian formalism floating around, and those constraints will themselves, classically, their Poisson bracket will be isomorphic at a given point to the whatever Lie algebra you put in. Imagine you're doing SUN gauge theory, then the constraints, the so-called Gauss constraints that appear when you make this Hamiltonian decomposition, they will just form the relevant, will be isomorphic to the relevant Lie algebra of SUN. And then this phenomenon might still appear, that you cannot preserve this at the quantum level. And then you say, aha, I have an anomaly. My gauge invariance, classically, that's how it's usually phrased, is broken at the quantum level. It's just no longer there in the form I hope to. And this is called a gauge anomaly, especially in the context of gauge theories, gauge field theories. But of course, it works in principle for any, it works in principle also for something like gravity. You see here, I would be keen, for instance, to reproduce the Dirac algebra at the quantum level, and the very same thing could happen. You know, I work out what the commutator of two of these constraints is, and I pick up extra anomalous terms in a specific quantum representation. And what does that mean? It means the quantization method fails, okay? Because it doesn't reproduce an essential feature of the classical theory. Of course, unless you find some very good physical interpretation of why it should be so. Okay. Now, how does this Dirac quantization play out for gravity? Which form does it take? Well, I start with formally with a Hilbert space. Sorry. It's not a Hilbert space, it's just a function, it's a space of wave functions. That's why I'm putting it in inverted commas. I'm not specifying really the scalar product usually. I just say there are some kind of amplitude where, you know, I imagine these are kind of the analogs in infinite dimensions of square integrable wave functions, but now of the, not of x or q, but of the fields, the hijs. So that's step number one. Step number two, one promotes the classical, kind of the fundamental Poisson brackets of the dynamical variables, phase-based variables, to canonical commutators. Let's just continue on the other blackboard here. So that means one requires, you know, H, some self-adjoint operators Hij of x pi conjugate momentum operators pi KL in such a way that they reproduce the classical right-hand sides modulo factor of IH bar delta JL plus delta IL delta JK three-dimensional Dirac delta function. Now, you will recall this here, that was the identity on the space of symmetric two tensors, right? This is why this always appears now on the right-hand side. So once you have this, and then you're supposed to quantize the constraints. These curly H's, consisting of the Hamiltonian constraint, H perp, and the three diffeomorphism constraints, and demand that these H mu's on physical wave functions give you zero. And lastly, kind of in order to complete the story, so that you have a proper Hilbert space, you need to endow this final physical space of wave functions with a scalar product. Okay. So then find a scalar product on the space spent by these physical wave functions. Let me write it like this. Space of all the phi physical to get some Hilbert space, H physical. Now, well, you see, what I've done here is I've copied the quantization recipe, which I would follow in kind of Schrödinger quantum mechanics, and just closed my eyes and said, oh, hopefully this will all go through in this quantum field theoretic case. Now, there are clearly a bunch of problems which one can point to immediately. Namely, if one compares this with the classical theory, you might know this is a nice little theorem that says whenever you have kind of a pair of kind of conjugate X hat, P hat, self-adjoint operator satisfying this algebra here, then not only does it have an essentially unique representation, but the spectrum in the quantum theory of both X and P will be the entire real line. Okay. So even if I now make, you know, I assume, well, something like canonical quantization will go through in the quantum theory, there is clearly something that this type of quantization is potentially in conflict with, because as we've seen, this has interpretation of a metric, so it's not a totally arbitrary symmetric two-tensor, but in addition we require that the determinant should be larger than zero. And clearly, if there really was a kind of Schrödinger quantization I'm performing here, well, these components individually would just have as a spectrum the entire real line, right? If I should believe this and argue in analogy with that here. So it clearly is already in conflict with a property that I might expect to be there from the classical theory, namely this determinant condition. Okay, so that's one point. So that these canonical commutation relations, I should write, as I've written them down on this blackboard, do not respect positivity, namely that h larger than zero, apparently, at the quantum level. And the reason, of course, why this is so is that, of course, it's the p's, or here's the pi's, they generate, the flow they generate, you know, goes to arbitrary x's or q's or whatever, or metric components, h. So it doesn't stop at zero or at whatever, you know, wherever I have a bound on the matrix entries of hij that follows from this determinant condition. Okay, well, the second point is really that this type of Schrödinger quantization doesn't, strictly speaking, go through at a field theoretic level. And in particular, of course, you know, in quantum mechanics, we have these square integrable functions with respect to the Lebesgue measure on the configuration space. There is no good field theoretic analog of that Lebesgue measure on these infinite dimensional function spaces. So that's the second point. There is no functional Lebesgue measure that one would need for this type of naive quantization to go through. So I call this, you know, curly capital D hij. And that means kind of, well, I'm just writing these down kind of somewhat formally to start with. So it's highly doubtful that there's any, I can make this rigorous in a mathematical way. Beyond perturbation theory and Fock space quantization, of course, that is always possible. And of course, certainly, the problem we have already mentioned various times, there are operator ordering ambiguities. And let me just remind you. So let me just write down what a naive quantization of these classical constraints would look like. Yeah?
Operating order, operator ordering ambiguity, like it's general in any quantization. Usually it's solved by using like normal operators. So is it general?
Well, on Fock space, well, you can. That's a question. Can you find, I'll get to this, I discuss now the quantum constraints. Can you find, usually one would be happy to find an ordering to satisfy these consistency conditions, say, for the algebra. One would be very happy. But the issue is that usually you are unable to find a single ordering. Because here it's not just, in a way, it's more complicated. I mean, it's not just, but it's more complicated in gravity because you have the Hamiltonian, where I've emphasized various times, you definitely have a kinetic term that always has a configuration space variable dependent coefficients. So it's not a pure pi squared term. So there, you definitely get operator ordering problems. You could say, okay, I just choose a specific prescription, but then you still have to take care that now the algebra of this particular Hamiltonian constraint with together with the other diffeomorphism constraints has the right form and doesn't pick up, say, any anomalous terms. And that's, of course, also strictly dependent then on the operator ordering you choose. So let me now make kind of a choice, a popular choice, which has various advantages. Let me now put in the quantization of these rather complicated expression, let me put all momenta to the right. So that is certainly a transparent, arbitrary but transparent prescription, which one can use. And that results in the following form of quantization, a condition for these spatial diffeomorphism constraints, or their operators rather, which is of the following form. minus 2, partial derivative, covariant spatial derivative, dj on h on ik. And now where I had now a pi dependence, I just substituted by the partial differential with respect to the conjugate variable. So that is kind of, I pretend there is a Schrodinger type quantization which I can use. So that gives me a minus I h bar. Functional differentiation with respect to h k j on psi equal to 0. So this is just obtained by taking the classical constraints, putting the momenta to the right, and converting them to partial functional differentials. Okay. And secondly, I do the same for my Hamiltonian constraint. I quantize it and let it act on wave functions, putting all the momenta to the right. What I get is a minus kappa squared h bar squared Wheeler de Witt metric curly g I j k l. Now, of course, this is my kinetic term, so I get a double derivative with respect to hij and hkl minus a potential term, square root determinant of h, which, of course, h is represented here formally by multiplication, and three-dimensional scalar curvature, which doesn't depend on the momenta, applied on the wave function psi should give 0. Now, this equation here in the bottom line is the famous Wheeler de Witt equation. So now let's discuss a little bit more what these do. Actually, it's not so difficult to make sense of these spatial diffeomorphism constraints. The reason for that is that they are linear in the momenta, right? And then you can also see what turns out, at least kind of formally, is that they will reproduce the correct Lie algebra if I stick to this factor ordering, and they can be seen. Now, this has, of course, this has as an argument hij, and you can actually see that they generate infinitesimal translation, they act on the wave function as if they were generating infinitesimal translation of the argument hij. Okay, so it's actually quite straightforward to see that these quantum constraints, so three times infinity, they do generate spatial diffeomorphisms. So they really, so in other words, so if I have a wave function, psi, hij, that is annihilated by all of these spatial diffeomorphism constraints, then one can show that psi ij of hij is only a function of diffeomorphism equivalent classes of these metrics. So it is, rephrasing this, it is a diffeomorphism invariant functional of hij. So this is very much along the lines of the simple quantum mechanical example I presented to you yesterday, right? So I had then said, okay, again, going back to this, I had a single constraint, P3. So that's, of course, linear in the momenta, as is this constraint here in this field theoretic context. And the wave function that were annihilated by those were those that were constant along the orbit generated by this P3. And that orbit was the orbit where Q3 changed its value. And the same thing is true here. I have this bunch of diffeomorphism constraints. They are linear in the momenta. And they act in such a way that if this annihilates the wave function, the wave function doesn't depend on just arbitrary degrees of freedom in the hijs, but it depends only, it doesn't depend on things that change when you go along the gauge orbits induced by the diffeomorphism action. So if that is the case, this only depends on diffeomorphism equivalence classes of these hijs. It only depends on what we called geometries, or what I also mentioned to you is called superspace. So it projects down from the space of all Riemannian three-dimensional metrics to the quotient space where I have declared pairs of metrics as equivalent if there is a three-dimensional diffeomorphism that gets me from one to the other. So the superspace was this space of all orbits, or the space of geometries. Yeah? So this, what these constraint conditions therefore incorporate is to say, aha, psi needs to be a function on superspace. Okay, I mean, of course, so far this is just words, but it's clear that, well, this is what should happen. Of course, it doesn't mean yet that you have an easy access, say, to parameterize what these are. But in principle, the interpretation is as transparent, I would say, as in this finite dimensional quantum mechanical example. So it's a functional on superspace. This space of geometry is also... on superspace. I'm not sure whether I said I called superspace. I think I called superspace the space of all metrics. Here, what I mean is the space of all geometries, so of equivalence classes. Now, it comes to discussing this Hamiltonian constraint. Things are much, much, much more complicated, and that's due to various reasons. So first of all, the first thing to recognize is that this is quadratic in the derivatives. So this is just singular. And as any kind of kinetic term that appears in any quantum field theory of that type, it will need to be regularized and, well, possibly renormalized. So it will just generate infinities as it stands. So I have, and that is not very specific to gravity. But of course, what is specific to gravity is that one is here moving outside as a framework, I mean, that's what we're trying to do, outside the framework of perturbative quantum field theory. Yeah. So this would clearly be necessary. So So I call this, just to refer to it. So the Hamiltonian constraint must, something we must do about regularizing this infinity and extracting finite physics from it, so we're normalizing it in some way. And actually, it turns out that this cannot be really separated from the factor ordering issue. So here I've chosen a specific factor ordering with the differentials or the momenta all to the right. But of course, these guys, as we know, they are still dependent on the metric. Now, if I start regularizing in the simplest case, I can kind of try and smear out, for instance, this delta function like a singularity. Again, what I'll use to do that will be, well, metrics of some kind. So these two problems, in practice, cannot actually be separated from each other. So let me just write this down. So this cannot be separated from factor ordering issues. Now, I still haven't said anything about what happens to the constraint algebra. And of course, well, strictly speaking, once I come to this expression here, well, this is ill-defined. I mean, I take an ill-defined quantity and I compute its commutator with something. It's just not well-defined. But if you just kind of blindly close your eyes and imagine, you know, I could make sense of that in some Hilbert space and just do kind of the computation, the Dirac algebra doesn't come out right. So you find anomalous terms in it with this specific factor ordering. Even, as I said, closing your eyes to the fact that you're doing something very formal and that there is no way in which this can be said to be a well-defined operator of any kind, you know, with any kind of mathematical rigor on a specific Hilbert space or Hilbert space auxiliary or otherwise. So it doesn't come out right. So, well, then of course one can in principle try and play around with factor orderings. Now, but also of course, you see, this, yeah, so the issue of course of the Dirac algebra is also of course tied to these two things, because if you regularize it, then you'll have something like a regularized version of the Dirac algebra. And for sure, it will have some extra terms floating around. And then you have to say, well, if once I remove the regulator, this should kind of vanish in a well-defined way. There are problems over problems. Now, of course, what is another problem we haven't yet talked about is, well, how on earth am I going to solve this equation? What are its solutions? Maybe even formally, what are its solutions? So here, there is some group structure that came to my help to say, aha, well, anything that's a functional on the space of geometries will basically lie in the kernel of these operators. In the kernel means it's annihilated according to such a condition. But about this thing, well, there is, it has nothing directly to do with the diffeomorphism generator. It's just this quadratic expression. So that's kind of the analog of the closest I come to a Hamiltonian here. So it's this Hamiltonian constraint. And of course, if there are problems anywhere, I expect them to be here. And they are here, massively. So at least in this formulation, we have no idea how to solve this equation. how to solve this equation, kind of in the full theory. And again, note, yeah, the complicated not even polynomial dependence on your configuration variables, h, I, j, both as it appears in the De Witt metric, so inverse and here in the square root of h, well, the De Witt metric, no, I'm saying something wrong, that is polynomial, apart from determinantal factors floating around here, but also I still have the three-dimensional scalar curvature, which has derivatives, and certainly inverse matrix Hij appearing in it. Yeah?
But what about equation number one? Okay, yeah? Can it be solved in the closed form? Because it just...
Yeah, you have to make sense of what you mean by functions of superspace. Mm-hmm. I think it's in principle not... Well, what is the square integral function on superspace? So I'm. It looks, one should think there would be some mathematical machinery to deal with that. Actually, I'm not completely sure. I'm not completely sure what one can say rigorously about this space. There is certainly. I seem to recall that there, even at that kind of kinematic level, that there are issues there of what this. What is the Hilbert space of these things? Can one write down, a meaningful scalar product? And I would say, this is the thing that is changed when you go to this loop representation. There you generally have kind of well-defined kinematical structures, and these things will depend on gauge equivalence classes, or they will be labeled by Wilson loops. You get to this. And then, at least you have a kind of a rigorous mathematical framework to talk about the solution space of these guys. And it improves on this metric formulation. Although, well, the problems you have with the Hamiltonian constraint essentially remain. But, I'm jumping ahead. So, I recall there are, even at that level, there are issues there with this is kind of the geometric formulation of canonical quantum gravity based on the metric. So here's the Riemannian three metric as opposed to some gauge connections. So there is yet another issue, and that doesn't have to do with this specific formulation. Of canonical gravity or quantum gravity, but it has to do with this issue of a time. I said, well, this is the closest we get to a Hamiltonian of the system, but it's of course not a Hamiltonian, but it's a Hamiltonian constraint. You know, its value evaluated on physical wave functions is zero. If you recall, we did of course have a Hamiltonian, so which was a linear. Which was a linear combination of these constraints where the coefficients were the lapse and the shift vector. Now, if I was now going to write down, take this Hamiltonian and write down an analog of the Schrödinger equation, kind of in this naive way, assuming all these operations, kind of these operators can be made well defined in some way, what I'd get is the following equation. So this is just left-hand side Schrödinger equation equal to, well, Hamiltonian. Remember, I wrote down the Hamiltonian. This was the three-dimensional integral depending on lapse and shift applied on psi of t. So I can clearly just write this down in analogy. But of course, now recalling that this was a linear combination of the constraints, this here annihilates wave functions if they are physical wave functions. So actually, the right-hand side of this is plane zero on physical wave functions. So by my earlier logic, and that brings one back to the question, well, nothing seems to depend on time, right? The wave function doesn't seem to depend on time. What's going on? Am I interpreting this formalism in the right way? So kind of what then this equation d by dt psi equal to zero seems to express is something that people have called kind of frozen time. Now, if I take this as at face value, yeah, this was just some coordinate time. Well, but never mind. It seems nothing depends on it. Again, does it mean, you know, dynamics is frozen? Well, most certainly not. But so how to interpret this equation? Now, one last comment I want to make, and we may actually look at that next week. Here again, this De Witt metric appears, right? And that just gives me the coefficients of the pi squared term, of the momentum squared term. Now, an interesting property this has is that actually, remember, this was a bilinear, essentially, in the metric Hij. You can actually look at the signature of this as a metric on symmetric two tensors. So if I kind of forget about the x dependence, just look at, you know, what happens at a given x, and this is just an expression that tells me how to take the scalar product of two symmetric two tensors with each other. So I can ask, so it's a metric, it's a scalar product, so I can ask what is the signature of this metric. And the space on which it operates is the space of symmetric 3x3 tensors, so it's a six-dimensional space. And it turns out that the signature of this metric at every point x is indefinite. So it's not positive definite. Yes, so that's kind of a, you might see, is a curiosity. But so the De Witt metric, this curly J, has indefinite signature. Signature, and it's a six-dimensional space. It has a signature that is minus plus 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 plus. So what you see here is something rather bizarre. You see, of course, what you would expect if that was a standard kinetic term, of course, this should be positive definite, right? Any p squared, any component of p, enters with a positive sign. It's just part of the energy, part of the kinetic energy. But here, bizarrely, you see there is kind of one direction in the space of the symmetric two tensors, which is associated with a negative kinetic energy. And this is a so-called conformal mode of the metric. So you can ask yourself, you know, in my metric degrees of freedom, which one is it? It's the one that is responsible for scalings of the metric. And you see that if for some reason I wanted to treat this as a genuine Hamiltonian, it's a very, very non-standard thing, because for one thing, it won't be, its spectrum will not be bounded from below, because it has, you know, one of the components, one of the modes of the metric, just enters with a minus p squared in the energy, right? So, and you might say, oh, maybe that comes from the Lorentzian structure of my original metric GMU nu, but this is not. It has actually nothing to do with it. Even if you start from four-dimensional metrics that are fully Euclidean, so not even Lorentzian, you find the same feature. So it has nothing, it's got nothing to do with that, but it's a conformal mode, and that is kind of the one-line reason for why a naive Euclidean path integral, where you get things, you look at, you know, amplitudes e to the minus s. I understand that's something that Ruth Gregory mentioned in her lecture today. This is called ill-defined because here, somewhere up in the S, you have a term dt. You have a term of the metric, a mode of the metric that enters with a minus sign. So you have a minus phi dot squared term here. And of course, if you make that oscillate very strongly, you see it gives an e to the whatever, plus phi dot squared. And this can grow without bound. So this gives you immediately gives rise to a very bad divergence of the Euclidean path integral. So it has all kinds of ramifications. Here, I just want to point this out, if you like, as a curiosity. Anything more I wanted to say about this? Well, really, the upshot. So one more thing that follows from this observation there is this: these equations will have hyperbolic character, so you have this mixed signature in front of the kinetic term. So if you really want to start quantizing this, well, it's a little bit like solving a kind of a Klein-Gordon equation for relativistic particle, but that it's just an aside. And the same feature also appears when you look at reduced versions of this problem. What do I mean by a reduced version? You can say, okay, this appears to be in full generality for full quantum gravity with all the degrees of freedom in there. It seems an intractable problem. And that's more or less the conclusion that people had reached, well, 15 years or so ago, 15, 20 years ago. They say, well, playing around, not really be able to, well, make any halfway rigorous sense of these equations to start with, trying to play around with certain regularizations, which are tend to mess with the diffeomorphism invariance of the theory. You see, that's an additional requirement that wouldn't be there, of course, in a standard kind of quantum field theory on a fixed background. Not really being able to apply standard methods from relativistic quantum field theory to this full system. You know, I can just then say, well, you have no idea what to do. What you can do is you can try and impose additional conditions on your degrees of freedom. So make, say, additional symmetry assumptions on the metric HIJ, and then go to a vastly reduced configuration space, and in so-called cosmologies, I mean quantum cosmological models, you reduce the number of degrees of freedom from HIJ, kind of fully, the full metric field, to something like the scale factor, AFT, so a single mechanical degree of freedom. And then you can try and say, okay, let me just throw out all these other, disregard all the other degrees of freedom, and let me try and pull through this quantization program. And for very, very simple cases, you can make things work, although issues like that appear even there, say the issue of the metric, the minus here in the De Witt metric. So that's what I mean. That's a kind of a path you can choose. The full problem is too difficult. Then you simply by hand reduce, you know, the dimension of the configuration space by, for instance, yeah, requiring homogeneity and isotropy as you do in cosmology, or something that is maybe a little less serious, and try and see whether you can deal with that, can quantize this reduced model. Even if you can do that, what is usually completely unclear is what the relation of that is to the full theory, if there's anything at all. So that tends to be the problem there. So is one completely stuck in this approach? And, well, that leads me immediately to the subject of next week's lecture, namely the idea of, well, maybe some of these problems one has here are tied to the classical choice of variables one has chosen to describe the space of geometries. And that exactly brings me to an alternative formulation in terms of connection variables that has by Ashtakar's name associated with them. So these are things that came along in the mid-80s. Well, are we stuck here? And maybe the answer is no. Let's try something different. Let's try already classically to reformulate gravity in terms of connection variables. What means connection variables? Connection is like the gauge connections as they appear in electrodynamics or in non-abelian gauge theories. So connections of that type. So 86, 87, roundabout there. These were suggested. And so the one thing that one tries to use there is say, let us write down gravity in a form that resembles most that of a gauge theory. And we know much about the quantization of gauge theories. Maybe that will result, will resolve some or, you know, even a majority of the problems I'm finding in this metric formulation. So is that possible? Where does this kind of logic lead me to? Will be the subject of the next lecture. Have a good weekend.